you. Primary reason for that being that there's simply not sufficient evidence from which the jury could draw reasonable inferences of guilt that Mr. IU committed an act putting the victim in threat or fear that caused a sexual act, and with the attempted witness tampering, that there was no threat or intimidation or corrupt persuasion to influence the witness's testimony. I'd like to take the two convictions in that order, if I can, Your Honor. And I would start with the sexual abuse count. And I think the critical question at some level that has to be answered by the prosecution is, what is the act that caused fear by Ms. Badhand? What is the act that they say led to a sexual act? Because if you look at all the possible acts that are out there, they all have some flaw that makes them not connected to fear or threat that would lead to a sexual act. Now, I would take them a little bit in order. And if you look at the act that probably got the most attention at trial, it is the fight that took place the day before the sexual act. On November 20th, Mr. IU and his longtime paramour, Ms. Badhand, were driving around their community of Mandaree in rural North Dakota. At some point, they began to argue. Ms. Badhand acknowledges she slapped Mr. IU. Mr. IU physically abused her. Severely, indisputably. The sexual act took place the next day. There was no connection between those two things temporally. I mean, you've got more than 12 hours of time that passes. So you have a temporal disconnect between those two things. And at no point does Mr. IU refer back to that. If you look at Ms. Badhand's testimony, she acknowledges that one of the hallmarks of the relationship was when they had fought frequently, they had sex as an act of reconciliation, that was very common for her. She said, we have sex all the time. She talks about the sexual act itself, and she said, well, at some point I just let it happen because I wanted him out of the house. And she talks about the fact that when she was asked, was this sexual abuse, why didn't you report it as sexual abuse, she again says, we had sex all the time once we'd fought.
Counsel, I'm gonna throw you a little bit of a curveball, although I think it's a fair inference from the government's brief here, which is that if you look at the cause of the fight the night before, it was about infidelity and, you know, you have sex with other people, but you don't have sex with me, and you have relationships with other people. And then you look at this particular, and that caused the black eye and the drag-out fight. Right. And then you have her resisting here a little bit, you know, trying to keep her panties up and things like that. But then he mentions infidelity again. And shortly thereafter, maybe not immediately, but shortly thereafter, she submits. And I wonder if that creates enough of a connection. In other words, if I just got beaten up once my boyfriend or significant another, you know, I talked about an infidelity, that's a trigger. And so I'm just going to submit because I don't want to get beat up again because we're talking about that again. Why didn't that make the necessary connection?
Two reasons, Judge Strauss, I think. One is, if I can talk just a little bit about the pattern, right? Because we did spend a lot of time on the pattern. The case was well tried by the government, and we spent a lot of time talking about 2011 and 2015 and Kalolo IU is a bad guy, which, you know, by the record, that's hard to dispute. He's a bad guy and a bad boyfriend. But at no point in any of these instances did violence lead to sex, right? 2011, violence qua violence. 2015, she gets a pop can thrown at her. It's about their relationship. It's about other things, but it doesn't translate to sex. If you go then to the November 20th incident, and I think that's the second point about this, besides there's no track record of violence leading to sex, look at what Ms. Badhand describes and how she describes it. And I think assessing that testimony is where it's critical to look at the Fool Bear case that we cited in our 28J. You had a description by Ms. Badhand of what happens at page 59 of the trial transcript when she's asked question at line 9, okay, what happened? Answer, we had sex. And then after that, he got ready and somebody picked him up. There are a few more questions. Did you ever tell him no? Yup. Tell me what happened when you had sex, and what did he do? Ms. Badhand answers, I was still mad. I was being mad, but I told him I wasn't because I didn't want to start another fight. I didn't want to fight anymore, and I kept pushing his hands off and everything. So she describes in her testimony initially, she's mad, right? I don't want to have sex with you. I'm mad at you. She goes on to say, because I was mad that I had a black eye and he just beat me up the night before. How are you going to have sex with somebody that just, and then there's a question by the government, were you scared of him? Yes, that's the only time that she says she's scared of him, when the government sort of walks her into that.
But doesn't the thing about the I don't want to start another fight sort of feed my theory, which is they seem to fight all the time about the infidelity, and she might have just said, once he brought up the infidelity and they talked about that, that was it. I don't want a repeat of last night.
And so my answer to that, just Roz, is that you have to have fear or threat cause the sex. And I think her, if we want to call it flawed consent or consent of frustration or consent of just wanting to not be with him anymore in that moment, just get out of here. And if having sex is what it takes to get rid of you, that is in fact different than threat or intimidation, fear of violence that causes her to submit to sex. And one other point I would say, though, then, is you have to look at 2242. It is possible for the government to prove too much on this, right? Because the threat or fear has to be other than, when you look at 2242 sub 1, other than threatening or placing the other person in fear that they will be subjected to death, serious bodily injury, or kidnapping. So if you look back to the November 20th incident, that's serious bodily injury. If we were here on an assault resulting in serious bodily injury case and you ask me, is that, you know, evidence from which the jury can find serious bodily injury, I'd have to say yes. There's a black eye. There's bruising. And so I think one of the problems for the government referring back to 1120 is, at some level, it just proves too much because it's a fear of serious bodily injury.
Does her fear have to be connected to a sexual act? In other words, you've sort of presented the idea that her fear of him was sort of separate from mm-hmm. their sexual relationship. Could the jury still make an inference, though? You can make the jury argument, just as you're making here, that these two things have never been connected. Mm-hmm. But why couldn't a jury, based on the evidence, given, as I understand it, the evidence was that this was not the first time that there had been a physical assault on her, wouldn't it be reasonable for a jury just to infer, based on the circumstances, that general fear would play into whether or not there was consent?
Yeah, I mean, I agree, Judge Kelly, that the jury can look at and draw inferences from the totality of her fear. I would say, however, that the inference that they draw, which must be reasonable in the context of all the testimony, as Fool Bear lays out for us, has to be that the fear causes the sex. And I think that's the disconnect that exists, right? It would be impossible for me to say that Ms. Badhead had some level of fear of Mr. IU. I mean, just their circumstances and history would indicate that. But her testimony, when you look through it and how it's presented and compare it to Fool Bear, right, where the issue was force and the victim ultimately just sort of mirrored questions from the government, right, as opposed to independently saying, no, I'm afraid, and that led me to have sex. Her description of why she had sex was, we have page 63, she's asked, why didn't you tell law enforcement it was a sexual assault? She says at line 22, because I didn't. I mean, we have sex all the time when we get back together. So I think in the context of all the testimony and her response to the government question, it's just not reasonable to infer that her fear caused the sex. Something else caused the sex, which was, that's what we do, I wanted to be rid of him in that moment. She's not describing the fear. So I think, Your Honor, it's not an inference that is reasonable in the totality of the circumstances. And I think that's why, in particular, you know, when you consider the inferences, you do have to look at the overall trial strategy here, which was to demonstrate Mr. IU is a bad guy, right? The opening is you have to look at the chain. You can't look at these individually. You have to look at the totality. When, you know, she testifies, there's dwelling on the 2011 assault and the 2015 assault, the bad priors. When you get to closing, there's a discussion of you have to look at the history. She's living in constant fear. He's using sex as a weapon. It's really not what the evidence shows us. It shows us a horrifically flawed an abusive relationship, right? To some degree, both ways. But ultimately, what you need is that causation, right? And you need the ability to draw a reasonable inference that there is an act here. And I think it just has to be this 1120 act.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think there was testimony that there was a physical struggle before this particular sexual encounter. Where he tried to remove her clothing. There was a struggle.
She talks about that, Your Honor.
How long or how brief, but...
Right.
But I'm just wondering if that that fact is enough to provide the connection, to be kind of the bridge between these things that had happened before, the pattern that had occurred before, and now here we go again. There's a struggle, and then she relents out of fear of what's going to happen.
The thing I would say about that, Your Honor, is, again, drawing a reasonable inference of fear causing the sex, right? Again, none of the pattern has ever translated to sex. Two, her description of it at page 60 is when she's asked, is he trying to pull down your panties or your trunk? She says yes, and then what happens? I just let it happen because I just wanted him to be gone. He was going to go work cattle. So I don't think ultimately it's a reasonable inference that she was afraid. It's that she's sick of him, right? I mean, she just doesn't want him around anymore. And that's, I think, what's the reasonable inference there. The other problem with that, again, Your Honor, is if you tie the struggle, right, to her connection of fear, it is, again, this problem of proving too much, that it can't be a fear of serious bodily injury under 2242. And if you tie back to the event of the earlier day, that's certainly what it looks like, is, you know, the fear of serious bodily injury. If I can, I'd reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal, Your Honors.
Very well. Mr. O'Connick?
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court, opposing counsel. The United States is asking that you affirm both convictions in this case, the first being the sexual abuse charge and the second being the attempted tampering of a witness charge. Now, at the beginning of appellant's argument, he asked, what was the cause of the fear? Well, the standard of review here is de novo, and viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the jury's verdict, including any reasonable inferences. And that is really for both counts in the indictment. There were inferences where the jury could determine, did the defendant knowingly engage in a sexual act by placing Miss Badhand in fear or by threatening her? And did he knowingly also act with consciousness of wrongdoing by telling her to say that she lied, or to, excuse me, telling her to say that she had actually lied about the sexual act and to say that she should drop the charges? And appellant cites Fulbert, but I believe Fulbert is completely distinguishable from this particular set of facts. Fulbert was a charge of aggravated sexual abuse by force, and this court specifically highlighted the distinction between 2241 aggravated sexual abuse by force and 2242 sexual abuse by stating that it would render a distinction meaningless if we accept the factual situations in Fulbert. In this particular case, the fear that caused the victim to engage in sexual act was essentially a lifetime of abuse. Contrary to appellant's argument, the United States was not intending to paint Mr. IU as a bad person. The point was to demonstrate the pattern of abuse. Last year, this court in United States v. Johnson held a similar fact pattern was admissible for under 404B purposes. Now, although this isn't a 404B argument, the rationale that the court held here in Johnson is equally applicable to the present case. Specifically, in Johnson, this court had held that you can use the prior history to explain the defendant's intent, and that is exactly what the jury was able to do. The appellant's arguments here today were presented to the jury. He presented the argument of intent, and they wholly rejected it. And those inferences can be derived from the past abuse where he received a federal conviction in 2011 for assaulting her while she was pregnant.
Well, what about it seems to me that the evidence in the record from the victim was, well, this sort of thing happens all the time. We fight unhealthy relationship, we fight, and then we engage in sex later. If that's all you've got from your victim herself, can a reasonable jury just infer what they might be thinking about his prior actions? Don't they have to look at what the victim herself was thinking?
Absolutely, yes, Your Honor. I would say, though, that in this case, she specifically said she was afraid, that she was afraid she would get beat up again. Additionally, she explained that when the kids leave, I believe, it always gets worse. So she explained her fear. And even on cross-examination, when the defense pointed out to her about other acts, she talked about how she was in fear when he would come and kick in her door. Talked about the incident in 2015 where he slapped her, threw a pop can at her, as the appellant stated earlier. And I think the fear is reasonably inferred from her tone. The jury was also able to see her demeanor. In this case, the United States arrested the victim on a material witness warrant, as noted in our brief and in the record. She ultimately recanted in this case based upon the defendant in March after being arrested on a sexual abuse charge. He calls her from the back of a Three Affiliated Tribes Police Department vehicle and specifically tells her to say that she lied. And the jury got to see not only her testimony, but this video where the defendant is telling her, say that you lied. This is going to screw, F up my life and make me a sex offender. You got to get me out of this. Tell the prosecutor that you're going to drop the charges.
Counsel, before we get to the witness tampering, which is, I think, what you're touching on, I want to go back to the question I was asking opposing counsel about I've sat on a lot of domestic abuse cases over the years, and often the same trigger leads to the same pattern of abuse. Here it seems that Mr. Ayu's trigger was talking about infidelity and the fact that she'd had other boyfriends and things like that. Am I off base here? Because it seems to me that that's what caused the fight the night before. It got mentioned here, and then she sort of submitted, as she put it. I don't know if she used those words, once the issue of infidelity came up.
Yes, Your Honor, and I would argue that is the crux of the United States case for the threatening portion of it.
Okay.
That was taken as a threat by the victim. It was not just a fight. The fight that happened in the car was some slaps, some pushing, but the defendant earlier that evening on November 20th took her to his mother's grave, kicked her in the stomach, in the face. Her eye was swollen shut, and that was all about infidelity. Approximately 12 hours later, when he says he wants to engage in sex and she's resisting, he says the phrase, "You let everybody hit it except for me." And at which point, as she was at that time pulling up her panties, she stops and, in her own words, let it happen because she didn't want to get hit again. And that trigger of infidelity was a trigger specific to her and was ubiquitous throughout the entire case file. When the appellant talked about trying to paint Mr. Ayu as a bad individual, that wasn't the intent. If you even look at the conviction in 2011, that fight started over infidelity. This pattern of the relationship, as this court in Johnson stated, was relevant to talk about a defendant's intent, to talk about the relationship, gives the jury enough inference to say, this individual was beaten up 12 hours prior, was resisting, and then when given the phrase, "You let everybody hit it except me," she stopped resisting. And based upon that, that's sexual abuse. That's fear, because fear is very broad. It's broader than force. I believe that was stated in One Feather. Additionally, fear can be fear of bodily harm. And additionally, when it comes to the entire argument that we talk about in this case, the 404B context explains the defendant's intent. In this case, the court instructed the jury on knowledge, proof of knowledge, proof of intent, additionally about 404B. And the instruction specifically stated you can look at the defendant's prior acts to determine his intent, his knowledge. And I believe that directly contradicts the appellant's argument because the jury was instructed that they could infer those prior acts to explain the fear, in addition to the threat that the defendant made.
What is the relevance, though, of what Judge Shepard said? I mean, one of the things we said in Fulbert was we talked about the fact that force and fear were different and the two crimes were different. I hear you saying that fear is broader and force is narrower, but arguably those acts of pulling down the panties and the struggle might actually suffice for fear. It might have sufficed in Fulbert. I don't know. We weren't presented with those facts. Why do they suffice for fear, and are we just allowing that overlap that we were very cautious about in Fulbert to bleed in or to creep in if we were to accept those facts as evidence of fear?
I believe that it's absolutely applicable in this case that the victim was in fear and that the jury could infer that from the circumstances. And the fact that she's pulling up her panties shows fear. I believe the jury could say she's pulling up her panties showing she's afraid of engaging in sexual act in conjunction with the fact that he beat her up and had her eye swollen shut by assaulting her 12 hours prior. I believe that it's completely separate. Whereas in Fulbert, we're talking about pushing, shoving in a assault, a more of a force concept. In fear has to be more broad. And her fear could be attributed to getting beat up, as she stated, and that could be manifested in her resisting by saying no, and also by simply stopping to resist, like in the Reynolds case, which, although not exactly, it was dealing with a sentencing guideline enhancement, it was the same sort of situation. In that case, the defendant takes a minor victim out to a secluded location. He's ultimately charged with coercion and enticement, but he isolates her. He starts touching her, and she stops resisting because she was in fear. This court held that enhancement under the guideline range for an upward enhancement on as it relates to a 2242 sexual abuse was proper because she was in fear. And I think that's directly analogous to this case, which is the letting it happen cannot be viewed in isolation. We have to look at the totality of the circumstances. The appellant is asking essentially to view the sexual act for that 5 minutes when it happened, and even to a certain point saying, well, even what she did is irrelevant. It's his intent. What I had urged the court to do is look at the holding in Johnson in Reynolds and apply that same reasoning by stating, when you have a victim, a habitual victim of domestic violence, when she states that she's afraid, and ultimately when she is beaten up 12 hours prior, she's going to be afraid. And then you add that to the fact that she resists before the sexual act, and the defendant gives her a trigger that she takes as a threat, or the jury could infer as a threat, that you let everybody hit it except me, and then immediately reports it. And I want to argue that when we talk about some of the corroboration in this case, the jury got to hear that the Miss Badhand reported immediately that she went and got medical treatment. The DNA came back to the defendant as his semen. And
did she report she reported the physical assault? Didn't the sexual assault come out later?
It came out within a few hours, Your Honor. It was initially the first responding officer had asked her if it was an assault. She said it was a physical assault. That officer, Parisian, then asked, was it a sexual assault? And she said yes. So it was within that same time frame when the initial report was there.
But she didn't volunteer. She volunteered the information about the physical assault.
Yes, that's correct.
But that was not a voluntary...
I would say it's not voluntary. It was something that she did not initially state. I believe that at this time that Miss Badhand was in fear, as the evidence demonstrated. And I believe that goes to I haven't talked about the variance or the alleged hearsay statements because of the appellant has not raised them. But I would just like to point out that the defendant's act of tampering in March of 2017, when he calls the victim after being arrested, was additionally a potential motive for the victim to fabricate in favor of the defendant. Now, I know that in the appellant's brief, he specifically states that this is not something that is usually the course of action. Usually the defendant is the one that opens the door to it, and then the opposing party brings it in. But when Miss Badhand receives that call in March, she ends up recanting. And the jury got to see the tone, the inflection in that video recording, and the inflection is very scary for Miss Badhand. She is afraid of him, as she testified to, and that after she ends up recanting, the United States arrests her on a material witness warrant, and at trial she explains what had happened, that, you know, she had been called by both the defendant and the defendant's sister, asked to drop, you know, the charges, and ultimately, that can also be, you know, you can look at that as to why the Miss Badhand acted the way she did. There are all these forces at play that make her afraid.
Acted the way she did, and what action are you referring to there?
the action of not initially eliciting it right away that it was a sexual assault. At this point, she just wanted to be safe. She wanted to get out of there, I believe, as she testified. She wanted to go not be in that situation. She was in the video that was admitted from Officer Parisian's body camera. She's actually packing up all of her belongings and getting out. So at that time, the argument would be the fear is not only the fear of the sexual act that she's facing, but she's afraid that he'll come back. And that's why she acted the way I believe she did in terms of stating the physical abuse before the sexual abuse, Your Honor.
Counsel, I wanted to ask you about the variance, because, and I understand why opposing counsel didn't focus on it. We have concurrent sentences, and the lead charge is certainly the sexual abuse. But I got to tell you, I'm actually concerned about the post-indictment statements, the April 7th statement and the April 11th statement, because those were after the superseding indictment were given. And what I'm concerned, I'll be very specific, I'm concerned that the jury may have convicted the defendant of witness tampering, or some jurors may have rested their verdict on witness tampering based on the April 7th and the April 11th communications, which postdated the indictment. Make me feel better about that, because I don't feel very good about it.
Yes, sir. I would say that the instructions that the court gave about influencing a witness and 404B were there to explain how the jury could take those post-indictment bad acts. And specifically, when the judge admitted them, he admitted them as substantive evidence. However, we asked specifically to have it a limiting instruction for consciousness of guilt for witness tamper, for the witness tampering that occurred after the indictment. Additionally, this is one of several acts, I believe it's Bignod, where it explains that if there are multiple acts that ultimately, in this type of a case, that no fatal variance existed because in the indictment listed two fraudulent representations and the district court permitted the jury to consider other misrepresentations the defendant made.
Was the jury, though, was the jury instructed that you have to limit the verdict to acts preceding the return of the indictment, whatever it was, April 6th, April 4th, whatever the date of the indictment was? Was there some instruction on that?
Other than the two instructions that were given on the 404B and influencing witness, I do not believe so, Your Honor. However, I would state that it's still harmless error because, and I believe in Thompson, and I'll end with this, the United States focused its almost entire case on the witness tampering for the fact that the defendant had made the phone call on March 10th. And in Thomas, it explains about how that is permissible if the United States doesn't waver in its theory. Depending on your questions, that's all I have.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. You have almost 3 minutes.
I'll start where you ended, Judge Strauss. You should not feel good about that, because that's exactly what could have happened. The evidence of those post-indictment calls was challenged by the defense. They were admitted for substantive purposes. It is entirely possible that at least some jurors reached a verdict based on reliance on those, and the Plenteros case would indicate that alone is a basis for reversal. So you should not feel good about that.
What was the reasoning for not giving a limiting instruction on that?
The reasoning by the court?
The district. Was there a conversation about that with counsel, about why? Because it seems to me that might have been an approach that would have avoided the problem that possibly we're facing now.
It might have, Judge Kelly, I would tell you that that testimony came up along the way, and defense counsel got up and objected, and then there was an ongoing colloquy about that. It had been addressed pretrial. If you look at what the court does, it goes back after it says you can take these for consciousness of guilt. You can consider them as prior bad acts, and defense counsel says, well, now we're relying on post-indictment conduct. I don't know why the court didn't give it a limiting instruction. It's just not clear from the record, but they did not in a way that makes it clear that you could not rely on those as substantive evidence of guilt on count two. And I think that is fatal as to count two.
So was that brought up to the court by the defense, this issue?
The issue of admitting the post-indictment conduct was, Judge Shepard, at at page 267, Mr. Belmore talks about now we're using that indictment to find Mr. Ayoub criminally liable for events that occurred after the indictment was filed. He challenged that. Also, if you look at Plenteros, that is a sufficiency question. And the court sua sponte addressed the sufficiency on count two. So I think the court's
a little bit different, right? Though here we, at a minimum, you've got the March. It's identified as a March 10th audio, right? And I thought in Plenty Arrows there was some confusion from the victim as to when exactly.
Right.
The
I mean, there's
occurred.
Yeah. I mean, in Plenty Arrows you had sexual abuse conduct, and it's not clear exactly when it took place up to trial, right, because the victim was still in the house. This is different, but I don't think it's a difference that matters ultimately, right, because the allegation is on or about March 10. There was extensive discussion of what on or about means.
And that could include
right, and
April.
You had the April calls admitted as substantive evidence, right?
So if it were the other way around, the government would be arguing that on or about certainly would include early April from March 10.
Potentially, yes, Your Honor. But I don't think it matters in this instance.
Could I ask one additional question? One of the things that's a weakness of what I'm troubled about is, and this kind of goes the other way, is it seems like those later statements closed the loop on earlier statements. Like the April 7th statement was where Bad Hand told IU that things went well in an earlier conversation with police. And so I don't know that I buy the consciousness of guilt necessarily of the government, but there may be an argument here that those were not independent statements, that it wasn't a fatal variance because they sort of were related to things that happened prior to when the indictment, superseding indictment, was returned. I just am wondering what your response
sure.
is, because that's a key issue for me.
Yeah, I mean, I think if what the point you're making, Judge Strauss, is that this is sort of some interconnected
right.
effort, I think the problem is if it's interconnected and necessary to it, right, we're still reliant on post-indictment conduct. If it is, as you say, closing the loop, right, we're buttoning it down, we talk to her, she's on board, then it's a necessary part of the attempt to corruptly persuade her, and you're still relying for conviction on this post-indictment conduct. So I think it can be a problem if it's independently relied on or it's a necessary component of the full act of trying to persuade her.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you for your argument, counsel. The case is submitted, and the court will render a decision in due course. You may stand aside. Please call our next case.
United States versus Charles Cross.